The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Cineca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to stay on top of the most important news from China in just a few minutes a day with a free email newsletter, a handy smartphone app, and at the website subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you this week from Beijing, where I am delighted to see so many people. Let's hear some noise. Let's make some Beijing noise. Let's hear some, like, Beijing noise. All right, coughs are going to... No, it's a terribly smoggy day today.
The phone calls as well, please.
Right, phone calls as well, right. Everyone, please turn on your phone. And so with me, of course, is Jeremy Goldkorn, who is editor-in-chief of SubChina, who has not held unauthorized talks with any Russian diplomats and is therefore under consideration as a replacement for Michael Flynn. The Trump administration is considering him. I mean, Henry Kissinger was national security advisor, and he was a Jew also and a foreigner. So why not you?
There's hope.
Right. So greet the people, Jeremy.
Hello, Beijing. Thank you so much for spending your Valentine's evening with us. It's very romantic and we feel very special.
So this guy, he's got, you brought a date to, this is amazing. Classy guy. Keeper, absolute keeper, right? Absolutely. No question. So I want to thank the great folks for making their space available to us. It feels very formal. You guys should have ceramic teacups in front of you, and I should greet you all with, So this fall, the 19th Party Congress commences here in Beijing, and all indications are that it's going to be one for the history books. As Xi Jinping finishes his first five-year term, observers of elite politics in China will be watching carefully for what transpires in the run-up to this Party Congress. There is talk of Xi Jinping declining to name a successor, as general secretaries have done at the end of their first 5 years ever since Jiang Zemin's ascent. Some have suggested that he's going to break with tradition on other matters as well. Xi Jinping has been overheard telling Wang Qishan that 70 is the new 50, apparently. I keep hearing that, too. And if some dubious sources are to be believed, he's also mumbled that 20-year term is the new 10-year term. Anyway.
Xi's first 5 years in power have been marked by a consolidation of power, with Xi himself now elevated to the status of party core at the recent sixth plenum of the Chinese Communist Party. It's been marked by a sustained and far-reaching anti-corruption drive that has certainly helped in that power consolidation, by an illiberal turn in domestic politics with renewed emphasis on ideological rigor and party discipline, as well as a much more assertive foreign policy, a stalled economic reform agenda despite ambitious goals laid out by the third plenary session. Recently, we've also seen Xi Jinping take up the banner of economic globalization, a banner that Donald Trump has contemptuously cast aside, with Xi's speech at the World Economic Forum in January winning thunderous applause from the dark-suited men at Davos. And we know because Kaiser was there among the dark-suited men.
In a dark suit, no less.
I didn't think he wore a tie, but...
No, actually, you're not supposed to wear ties at Davos.
Sorry. Plebeian, they don't teach
us. It's to put us more in touch with, the common people. The optics are terrible at Davos, I know, I understand that. Anyway, so with us to talk about Xi's first term and what we should all be looking at as the 19th Party Congress approaches is, of course, Chris Buckley, reporter with the New York Times. Chris is a highly regarded and very resourceful reporter who has broken numerous stories despite the stubborn opacity of the Chinese political system. So we are absolutely delighted that he could make his debut on Cineca before this excellent audience. So Chris, welcome to Cineca.
Thank you.
Delighted to be here, especially on Valentine's Day. All I can say is that everybody here has some explaining to do when they get home. thanks very much for turning up.
We are continuing our series of Australian New York Times reporters based in Beijing, because we had Jane Perlez on Saturday night at the Bookworm, right?
Almost a faction.
Yeah, almost a faction. Right? three and it's a faction, right?
Chris, let's start with a trade craft question, if I can borrow some of the language of espionage. Kaiser described you as a resourceful reporter, and you're certainly known for getting the sources that matter and also for having an astute understanding of the Chinese political environment. So without, of course, giving away any secrets, perhaps you could tell us something about how you cultivated the connections you have and, you know, at least how you cultivated this reputation, if it's not true at all.
And give away secrets if you want to, that's fine.
Yes, I'm sure others are listening as well, so let's spill it all out. I actually feel humbled and daunted on trying to report on this place. And you know, if there's a perception that I have consistently reliable sources, then that's a misnomer. I find that reporting on Chinese politics is hard, and it's become harder under Xi Jinping. The system has always been opaque. It's become more opaque. The people who are willing to talk to foreign journalists has shrunk. And what those people know about what's going on inside has also diminished as well. So I think even people inside the system know less and can say less. So I've always found that reporting on politics here is rather like trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle or mosaic. It's not as if, at least in my case, there's a deep throat who can share all the secrets of what's going on. It's a matter of hearing something or observing something and trying to make sense of that by talking to other people and looking what's on the public record. But that's difficult, and I guess insofar as I have sources, I like to think of them as friends as well, people you get to know in Beijing who you can have an honest and lively conversation with about politics here and what they're observing and how they read the signals.
How high up are we talking about here? I mean, are we talking the Central Committee? Are we talking Politburo?
No. No, for God's sake, no. No
ministerial level sources?
I would wish. It's difficult. I think people in the business community now probably have better access, at least than I experienced as a journalist. And I think even they find it's increasingly difficult. So I think it's important that people understand, in trying to make sense of China and Chinese politics in particular, it's important, as I say, to eat your bran. In other words, to do the drudgery of reading what's on the public record and trying to make sense of that. And that's, you know, looking at the People's Daily, looking at the speeches of the top leaders, looking at the reaction that those speeches get from other officials. And that can also be a useful guide to what's coursing through the political system, which is, you know, otherwise hidden from our gaze.
Jeremy, you have a question there from a reader. From somebody in the audience. Christian, are you here? Christian Shepherd, is that right? Hey, Christian, how are you? I'll go ahead.
Okay, so Christian asked, and it's a related question. As a young China journalist, I'd like to hear Chris's thoughts on different tea leaves tactics. Cultivating sources aside, how else can you peek inside the halls of power? Is tracking personnel and factions everything? Does policy even matter?
I think tracking people and where they move is very important.
And is this accomplished through, like, placement of electronic trackers? Or
looking at promotions and demotions and dismissals in particular. I think that's what we're talking about here. Also, I think we have to have an open mind about how Chinese politics evolves. And sometimes I read academic analyses or textbooks or reports that talk about this faction versus that faction. I think it's important to remember that in any political system, loyalties change over time, and sometimes we can look at Chinese politics through an outdated prism. So without doubting that people have certain loyalties and personal ties, I do sometimes have a question about, for example, how relevant is it to talk about the Youth League faction these days, or even to talk about the so-called princelings as a unified caste that shares a sort of a has a shared view of the world, but also a shared political agenda as well.
So that's a reference, of course, to Cheng Li's kind of heuristic about how he understood, at least during the Hu and Wen period, elite factions of elite politics. So do you think that that was ever really relevant? Do you think that was ever a very useful way to understand the leadership? Or do you think that it was once and no longer is?
I think sometimes people can overstate the overwhelming importance of factions, even looking back at, say, the 1980s and 1990s. I think, for example, if you look at the Youth League, at least as I think of it, the Youth League was a historical product of the 1980s in particular. After the Cultural Revolution, Deng Xiaoping and the other leaders saw that they needed to nurture a new generation of leaders. And the Communist Youth League became an important ladder for identifying talent, nurturing it, and putting it in important positions. And so there was a particular reason then why the Youth League became this center of gravity, if you like, for a cohort of people who shared certain experiences and values and loyalties to their patrons as well. But I think, for example, in that case, its importance has diminished over time. And you can look at people who share certain personal ties still, but I think looking at it as a block of people who move through the system and are sort of patting each other on the shoulder and handing out favors all the time, I just don't think it works like that now.
I always found the princeling faction to be a more problematic idea. I mean, at least the with the CYL group, you could sort of draw connections between individual people. Mm. But I always felt like princelings never seemed to act in any kind of a block, and that wasn't particularly useful. What did you make of that?
No, I think that's certainly true. My contact with princelings is very limited, but from what I see and hear of them...
You don't have a Lamborghini, so you can't go to the right clubs.
I smashed mine, I'm sorry. From what we can see of princelings as a group, they share certain experiences that have... of being brought up in families which are heirs to Mao's revolution, and that inculcates in them a sense of entitlement or perhaps responsibility about the direction of the country. But we also see that they can also have quite different prescriptions about what is necessary for the survival of the Communist Party and also for China's prosperity as well.
So, Chris, Xi is the General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. He's head of Central National Security Commission, chairman of the Central Military Commission, Commander-in-Chief of the Army, chairman of the Central Commission for Integrated Military and Civilian Development, president of the People's Republic of China. He's also the top leader at the Central Leading Groups for Comprehensively Deepening Reform, Internet Security and Informatization, National Defense and Military Reform. Economic affairs. But I think it's worth saying them at length. It's extraordinary, so many leading groups. Why does he have so many leading groups that he's the leader of?
Well, he decor.
How are these leading groups used in the control of the government and the Communist Party?
Well, leading groups have always been a feature of Communist Party bureaucracy. I think they've become particularly important under Xi Jinping because after he came to power in 2012, I think there was a diagnosis of what had gone wrong under Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao that believed that decision-making in those years had become too lethargic, had become splintered among rival bureaucracies, and wasn't heeding Zhong Nanhai. And so... the leading small groups became one tool used by Xi Jinping to re-centralize power and to at least attempt to create a decision-making mechanism that was going to be more efficient, more authoritative, and carrying his unmistakable imprimatur as the leader of the Communist Party.
So part of his signature, obviously, and something that he's been carrying on since he was named in 2012 and took the throne, as it were, in 2013, has been, of course, the anti-corruption drive, which you know, has cast its net very, very wide with over 100,000 officials, great and small, having now already sort of gone down in it. What has it actually accomplished? I mean, and at what cost? I mean, has it actually frightened the party into kind of inaction, a fear of actually doing anything, lest it draw the unwanted attentions of Wang Qishan and his CDI? And as some have suggested, has it created kind of a latent opposition that might be conspiring against Xi?
This is a question I often ask myself as well, about just how deep and how effective has the anti-corruption drive been? I think there's a view out there that the anti-corruption campaign has largely been for factional or personal political ends and removing enemies or potential enemies of Xi Jinping in particular.
And apparently he has 120,000 of them?
Apparently.
Right. Okay.
Apparently. I tend to think that it's actually more than that. And that what we saw after Xi Jinping came to power is that he and other leaders had concluded, I think quite rightly, that corruption, certainly in the second part of the Hunwen era, had reached the point where it was brazen, where it was eating to the inner core of party authority, and was becoming a real source of social discontent as well. And in particular, it was eroding the pillars of party power, the military, domestic security, party organization, and party propaganda. And the fear was that economic corruption, it wasn't simply about illicit enrichment by officials, it was also diminishing their loyalty and responsiveness to the party leadership. And so that's why we've seen the description of corruption in official media also linked to problems of the emergence of factions and cliques as well.
Right.
So I think that's why Xi Jinping and other leaders took on corruption as one of the most serious issues that they had to deal with in their first years in power. Now, at the same time, I think it's true that they were selective in how that was applied at the very top of the party. I think it's generally true that, for example, princelings haven't suffered intensely from this campaign, but in a sense, that's politics, isn't it?
Right.
You're trying to achieve...
The costs of taking them down are simply too high, right?
Probably too high. So there are greater ends involved here, but of course there's selectivity involved in how you achieve those greater ends. All that said, I think it's probably true, and we all perhaps to some extent experience the fact that anti-corruption, the campaign for frugality and for clean living among officials has been a bit of a downer for a lot of them. And I think even officials who were not necessarily corrupt, but living off this, you know, these channels of grey income that were being generated by the government, have found their incomes diminished, and have found that their formerly comfortable lifestyles have become much more difficult. And that's difficult for officials who had invested their money in several apartments, say, or sending their children abroad. Suddenly that income pool has shrunk, and to hear friends who work out in the provinces or work in business, when they deal with officials, it sounds like getting a decision, getting a document stamped has become much more difficult. All that said, I'm still not convinced that this resentment that has built up in the party bureaucracy about the campaign against corruption has coalesced into some sort of forceful or concerted opposition against Xi.
What about lethargy? What about the sort of sapping of industriousness and of kind of initiative, which you also hear a lot?
That does seem to be a problem. So I think one of the paradoxes of Xi's particular recipe for transforming China is that it's centralized power. In some senses, it's treated the bureaucracy as, if not a foe, then certainly an obstacle to change. But at the same time, it has to use that bureaucracy as a tool for forwarding party policy. And how do you do that when you've told people that there are a bunch of lazy slackers who are right. sapping the authority of the party? I can understand if you're official, you're probably going to have mixed feelings about Xi's agenda.
So related to the corruption drive, or the anti-corruption drive, is of course the future of the man who Xi Jinping deputized to spearhead it, Wang Qishan. We've heard a lot of rumors about what's in store for Wang with the upcoming party congress, including the suggestions that he will not only remain on the Politburo Standing Committee despite the informal age limit rule, but indeed may be elevated to the premiership. Do you have a hunch either way on this? And if you're not willing to go out on a limb for any particular reason, what signals would you look for as an indication that an elevation is likely, or that there are going to be some changes to the way things are done?
Jeremy, this is a question that's been on my mind, I have to say. All I could say at this point is that there seems to be so much talk out there from serious people about the possibility of Wang Qishan staying on that I feel compelled to take that seriously, although I was initially more skeptical about the idea. It seems to me that you can mount a case that there's a strong argument to be made for keeping Wang Qishan on, possibly making him premier. You can also make a strong case on the other side that this would defy expectations within the party of a retirement turnover at the next Congress, and that whatever problems there are in policy making, they don't justify, for example, removing Li Keqiang as premier. So I can see arguments on both sides, and I think the important thing to remember at this point of the political cycle is that it seems to me extremely unlikely that the party leadership itself has reached any conclusive decision on this. So if I'm hearing that somebody's saying that she has decided this, this, and this, and this about Wang Qishan, I'm just very skeptical, because it seems to me that many of the personnel decisions before the Congress come together as a set of solutions, and that set of solutions is really only hammered out, I wouldn't say days before the Congress, but certainly weeks or a few months before the Congress. So I think at this point, it's important for us to have an open mind, because these things haven't been hashed out yet. But as things stand, I think it's worth thinking about that seriously and taking into account the arguments for Wang Qishan staying on, but also looking at the pressures that may make it much more likely that he retires as well.
Well, Chris, there's also this persistent rumor that, of course, you must have also been on your mind quite a bit about Xi Jinping declining to name an heir apparent at the coming party congress and deciding that he's not going to follow recent precedent and hand off the presidency after 2 5-year terms. So same question. So what do you think, and what signs would you look for short of Xi actually coming out and stating his intention that
Yes, I did write a story about this, coming to writing that story is sort of an exploring the sources and talking to people and trying to present readers with what you think is the most plausible argument for what might happen, all the while knowing that nothing has been decided yet. So in that case, I think the reason why I decided to pull the trigger on the story is that I just wasn't seeing the signs of movement of officials, particularly at the provincial level, that suggested that there are preparations afoot for certain people to be moved in positions that would then lead to them going to the Politburo and then eventually the Standing Committee as likely heirs apparent to Xi Jinping. And I think several months on that story, we still don't see those signs. Mm-hmm. Now, Xi Jinping and Chinese politics is full of surprises, but what I would be looking for in the following months is any signs that movement of personnel is either happening or not happening. Not having a clear successor, at least fairly quickly after the 19th Party Congress, creates procedural difficulties for when an heir apparent will emerge and how an heir apparent will emerge and then be put into the top tier of power, the Politburo Standing Committee.
So who are some of the provincial party secretaries whose movements or lack of movements we should be sort of keeping an eye on?
Now, this is the part of the conversation where I make the terrible confession that I have a terrible, terrible memory.
Well, you can name some provinces. We don't need people. or we can just move on to Jerry's.
So, you know, I don't want to dwell on that too much, so partly because I always make mistakes and have to Google stuff and then check things again and again. But, you know, yes.
Okay, nicely done, Chris.
but having said all that, I think the argument I would put is that the people who seem to be in place as, you know, perched in positions that would make them the most likely next generation of leaders. I'm thinking of Sun Zhonghai in Chongqing, for example, or Hu Junhua in Guangdong. They've remained in place, and I'm not privy to their conversations with Xi Jinping or anybody else, but it seems to be a working relationship there, but nothing that says that Xi is wrapping his brawny arms around them and saying, "You're my guys." At the same time, the leaders who seem to have some affiliation with Xi Jinping, going back to his days particularly in Zhejiang, they seem a bit too young and inexperienced so that they're plausible people to step into the breach as successors at the next party congress.
That's what they said 5 years ago about Hu. And he was sort of still the darling of people who held out hopes for political liberalization. How's his star these days?
I wish I had a sensible answer to that question. As I said, I would have guessed if he was really being nurtured as the next leader, we would have seen perhaps a movement from Guangdong at some point, or some indication in terms of personal appointments that he was being considered, you know, as a front runner for the next top spot in the leadership. We haven't seen that. Now, some people say that's because he belongs to this Youth League faction. Having said that, I'm a little bit skeptical about factions. Xi Jinping doesn't seem to place a great deal of stock in people who have risen through the Youth League, and that may count against him as well. All that said, it does seem that he seems to be a reasonably competent, reasonably skilled politician, and it may be that he goes into the standing committee at the 19th Congress, but even then, I wouldn't be entirely convinced that he's the guy who's going to replace Xi Jinping.
So, Chris, next month, the two meetings of the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference take place here in Beijing. Are you just groaning in anticipation of a really boring set piece, or do you have any expectation that something interesting might come out of it?
The first. you flagged this question to me, and I thought, I better check out on what to get ready for at the National People's Congress. So I was asking friends, and when I ask people what to get excited about at the National People's Congress, I tend to get glazed stares or derisive laughter. I think we're marking time at this point of the political cycle. We may see some other personnel changes before and after the National People's Congress. But my experience of the National People's Congress is that, as we've seen the party centralize power, It's become even more of a sort of a promotional vehicle than a deliberative body than it was before. Now, my experience, say 10 or even 15 years ago, was that some People's Congress delegates would have bright ideas and would be relatively candid about discussing them. You know, this would be sort of educational reform, for example, or problems in the health system. I find when I go each year now that the officials and delegates of the Congress are so afraid of speaking out of line that it's much more difficult to find interesting stories there.
But it's always amusing to see what the state media photographers decide to put up on.
That's right. That's right.
Very amusing. Yes. But, you know, there is that one possibility that something will come out of this whole Xiao Jianhua affair, right? I mean, his alleged abduction from Hong Kong is said There are some people who suggest that it was time to happen before the NPC, that he was to be sort of kept under wraps, and that he may be involved in some sort of a that he may be a sign, as Min Xinpei has argued, of an incipient power struggle going on at the top. Other people like Cai Xin put out a piece over the weekend saying that Xiao Jianhua, his Tomorrow Group, had such a sort of stranglehold on some of the important financial media that was the real reason he was taken down, as sort of part of this anti-corruption drive. What do you have a? I mean, you wrote a piece with Paul Moser about the abduction, and
that was my colleague Mike Forsyth.
Oh, it was Mike. I'm sorry.
I'll take credit. That's
right.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Sorry. Yeah, right. I get the two of you guys mixed up. You know, because you look so similar.
So just to back up, this is the Chinese-born gazillionaire who was who was escorted out of the Four Seasons Hotel in central Hong Kong, and
that's good. That's a good word.
Spirited across the border into China to help the authorities with the. See, I can just write this stuff.
You
like
can
this.
Write this stuff. Yeah.
So all we have at this stage is theories and conjectures about why the authorities have taken this step. I think what we have to remember on this point is that we had the abduction of the five Hong Kong booksellers over a year ago now, wasn't it?
Right.
And that created a big uproar in Hong Kong. This time the reaction in Hong Kong has been milder, but I think the decision makers in China who decided to take in Xiao Jianhua would realize that there's a political cost to pay when you take extrajudicial action like this to take somebody in. And if they're willing to take that step, there must be some sort of compelling reason that goes beyond the usual run of financial infractions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's just my conjecture. Now, exactly what that is, then we step really into the realm of theory.
Right.
And one of those theories is that Xiao Jianhua may have information about people that party leaders would rather not sit with him in Hong Kong. I think that
sounds quite plausible. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. I think one other important thing to remember thinking about this is that I was thinking about this today, actually. No, we're coming up to the 19th Party Congress, and part of that is going to be selecting the next cohort of officials. We also know that there's going to be a great deal of turnover in the financial bureaucracy. And I think Xi Jinping has signaled that he doesn't want to promote officials who are tainted by corruption or disloyalty. And it may be plausible that an investigation has indicated that Xiao Jianhua has information that may be helpful in identifying people, for example, who may have been leaking information or doing underhand business deals. And that kind of information would also be helpful, not just at looking at misdeeds that already happened already, but also looking forward to try to winnow out who do we want to select in the next cohort of financial bureaucrats in particular. That's just a theory on my part, but I think what we're doing is looking for plausible explanations that go beyond simply dealing with this as a sort of a financial infractions case.
Right.
Chris, you have a, if I may change the direction of the questioning.
Please
a little,
do.
You have a great Twitter account at Chu Bai Liang. You link to a lot of interesting stories in the Chinese press that, you know, one doesn't see in the international media. And your tweets are sometimes very funny. I think, you know, you've got one of the few Twitter accounts that actually makes me crack up into very loud laughter quite regularly.
But are you going to ask him, are you the man responsible for the relevant organs?
No, I'm not.
Yeah. Are you actually flatly denying it?
But how has Twitter changed the way you work and the way you get or keep up with the news, if at all?
I do sometimes take to Twitter. I sometimes have the embarrassing experience now of meeting people, and they say, "Oh, Chris Buckley, I see you on Twitter," and then I have to say, "Well, I have this part-time job working for the New York Times as well." I read the news pretty regularly anyway, and if I see something that I find interesting or amusing, then I sometimes put it on Twitter, partly to share what interests me, partly as a reminder to myself so I can go back and look at my Twitter feed and remember what was interesting. And over time, I found that people like pictures of pandas and livestock as well. So that that goes into the mix as well. One of my general rules is I sometimes enjoy making jokes on Twitter, but I try not to mock people or to be too sarcastic about things.
And yet.
And yet.
I'm going to go back and be boring and ask you some more about the 19th Party Congress. Because I think we have this rare opportunity to speak to you. I want to understand what we ought to be looking for as China watchers. Just what bellwethers, how are we going to, what signals might we look to ascertain the direction of the winds as the Party Congress approaches? I mean, you've already been very good about looking at, for example, these provincial party secretaries and or governors and movement from there toward the center, preparations for that kind of thing, relocation companies and stuff. what other bellwethers? I mean, without giving away any of your trade secrets.
Oh, there's no trade secrets, I promise you.
Okay.
It's very difficult to be specific, but what I would say is the way that I think of the Party Congress is, as a newspaper reporter, we're trying to explain what's happening to a broader readership that can find much more amusing politics in Washington at the moment.
Unfortunately, so
explaining why one fairly drab group of male politicians being replaced by another fairly drab group of what will mostly no doubt be male politicians, why that matters can be a challenge for us. And as I think of it, the big question at stake here is, as you were saying before, over the past 5 years, we've seen Xi Jinping very deftly concentrate and amass power. And the question coming up at the Party Congress is he going to be able to engineer policy decisions, personnel appointments, and rule changes so that that concentration of power is consolidated and possibly continues into his next 5 years? Or are we going to see that the coalescence of forces within the party put some sort of brake on that, and that the kinds of statements that appear in the report to the Party Congress, any changes to the party constitution, and certainly any personnel changes, whether that marks some sort of apex or limit on the extent to which Xi Jinping is able to achieve his will as leader.
Right.
And I don't think we're going to get answers to those questions until the Party Congress itself. It's going to be a drawn-out process. But what we'll be looking for in the run-up to that is any signals about where the balance of power lies and whether we're going to be seeing personnel changes or indications about changes to the party constitution and other documents that give us clues about where the run of political forces is. I think we've already seen one of those important clues already.
What was that?
Which is the elevation of Xi Jinping to core leader.
In the sixth plenum, which was concluded last year.
The sixth plenum, right.
Which is, what was the significance of his elevation to core? I mean, what does that mean? And was it a surprise to anybody? Is it just another title, another star on his collar? Or is this something truly meaningful, as you're suggesting?
Did anybody see it coming? I think we all like to pretend that we had foresight. I think there were signs of it beforehand, but I personally should have seen it coming. Now I look back, but I didn't. There were some officials coming up beforehand and lauding Xi Jinping as a core leader, and that was one clue we had beforehand. What does it mean to say that Xi Jinping is a core leader? Well, it's a very vague title to carry, isn't it?
Right.
It's like celestial excellency. I mean, what does it mean? I'm not quite sure, but there are a couple of fundamental points about being a core leader that I think are important to remember. First of all, it's a position or title that doesn't have a clear use-by date. In other words, it doesn't say core leader for the next 5 years or the next 10 years. It's a mark of honor and prestige that says this is the leader who carries a particular authority, and his voice
his ideological pronouncements, his interpretation of party orthodoxy will sort of stand longer, right?
Will stand longer and matters even more than it did if he were mere party general secretary. That's one thing we know. The other thing we know is that his predecessor, Hu Jintao,
was not
anointed a core leader. Prior to that, Jiang Zemin was a core leader.
Yes.
And Jiang Zemin was a leader who was party general secretary for some time and then managed to hang on for, 1.5 years as
CMC chief.
As Central Military Commission chairman. And even after that, seemed to exercise a great deal of informal influence as well. So I should stress here, I'm not making any predictions about what happens after 2022. I can't make predictions about the next 6 months. But what I think it does suggest to us is that whatever status Xi Jinping carries into the future, for now he's being seen as a leader whose authority and prestige is considered first among equals and even higher than first among equals. And that must carry some weight when it comes to making decisions about personnel decisions for the next Congress.
So there's also the sense that even if he loses all his other titles, he'll still be a core leader. He will still be a person of influence.
A cloistered emperor.
Something like that. There are no rules about core leader, but it's a kind of halo that he'll carry around for the foreseeable future, at least. One other thing about when he was anointed core leader, that was in a party decision that also stressed the importance of what the party calls democratic centralism and a process of consultative decision-making so that all leaders have a say. So the party did stress that point again as well. And I think it's important to remember that. We're not talking about a personalist dictatorship here or anything like Vladimir Putin has been able to achieve. But I think if you look at almost all of the speeches from officials responding to the decision from that plenum, all of them stress the importance of Xi's status as core leader. I really haven't seen any speeches by officials saying the most important thing from the sixth plenum was democratic centralism. I think on the contrary, I did a word search early on, and it was overwhelmingly about the importance of being a core leader.
It's all about the core.
It's the core.
All right. Well, should we end with a question that was emailed to us by Mads Verstegra Nielsen? I don't know if I've got the
Mads, are you in the audience here?
Yes.
Okay. A Danish student of political science studying here in Beijing. And he's considering moving into the field of journalism after he graduates because Danish coverage of China and Chinese politics is, in Mads's word, inadequate. So the question is, since China has changed so much from when you guys got here the first time, what is your advice for aspiring coverers of China from where you stand and see China today?
Is this just for Chris or is this for all of us? It's meant for all of us, okay. Well, Chris, why don't you take the...
Kaiser, give me a few moments to compose my thoughts, please.
Okay, and I'll babble sensibly. I think that if there's anything that having been here for a long time confers on people, maybe like me, like Jeremy, and there are other people in the audience here I see tonight who have been reporting from China for a very long time, it's perspective. It's the perspective of time. There are people who came to China in the period after the Olympics and took it very much for granted that it was already a quite developed country. You know, when I came here in the early 1980s for the first time, there were still a lot of donkey carts, no privately owned automobiles, no buildings over maybe 7 or 8 stories in the entirety of the city. It was an entirely different city. I mean, the only way to sort of know, to have experienced that is to have experienced it and to sort of know how far things have come in that time. And it's something that as a newer reporter, you just have to keep drilling into your head. Just have to keep remembering that only 30 years ago, this was a radically different place. And I think that it actually made me have the effect of softening you and cutting the leadership a little more slack or giving them a little more credit for what they've been able to accomplish.
I'll give you another 20 seconds. I've got a really quick answer. The first rule is don't believe anything anyone ever tells you ever. start from a suspicion of disbelief, whether they're, you know, saying good things or bad things about the country or the government. Don't believe anybody until you've checked it. And the second thing I would say is you've got to get out of Beijing a lot. You know, and people who live in Shanghai, it's the same thing, because they're great, but they're bubbles.
No, I would stress the same point, that it's very important to get out of Beijing and expose yourself just to the tremendous variety of this place and the tremendous variety of experiences and voices. The other thing that I find is really important for staying in China and being here long term is the friendships that you form here. And I know people can have their bad experiences of China, and we don't like the smog.
I missed the smog.
You missed the smog.
I was so happy to come back and be like, oh, it's my Beijing. You still smell the same.
We put some on for you tonight. Yes, but for me, on the longer term, like those friendships that you develop and the privilege of being able to get to know people who've gone through the extraordinary changes that this country is experiencing is, you know, I remind myself all the time, it's a real privilege to be here. Day to day, it can feel a struggle. Can be quite crappy sometimes as well. But longer term, I just find it's a real privilege to do my job, but also to be here, especially at a time when there's so much at stake and there's so much changing.
Front row seat to the most amazing transformation, right? I mean, it's just a front row seat.
Exactly. Right? And you can have a bad day and you think, what am I doing here? But then you meet somebody doing extraordinary things or accomplishing things against all the odds, and you think, that's the privilege.
Chris Buckley, what a wonderful way to wrap this up. Let's give him a warm round of applause. Very wise words. I'm going to pay some bills, and then we're going to come back with questions from the audience for Chris. So before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SupChina on Twitter at supchina.com and on Facebook at facebook.com/supchina.news. If you like the Seneca podcast, by all means, leave us a positive review on the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store or wherever it is that you go to review apps. This really helps, and actually it helps people to discover the podcast, and it means a lot to us personally. So thank you for all of those who have done so already. Now, on to recommendations. Jeremy, what do you have for us?
Two things. The first thing is quite relevant to what we've been talking about today. It's an interactive infographic produced by the Mercator Institute for China Studies about the party's leading small groups. And you can...
You've been spending too much time on this, I can see.
Leading small
group obsession.
Yeah, I know. I'm obsessed.
He was memorizing these small group flashcards on the way over here.
So, yeah, that's a very useful... Well, I mean, I don't know if it's useful. I feel as though I'm doing something intelligent when I'm playing around with the different small groups. But the second thing I'd like to recommend is kind of slightly self-interested. It's a project I've been supporting for several years by making a website at greatwallfresh.com. And it's some buddies of mine who have a farmhouse at the village of Chenjiapu, where most people are surnamed Chen, and they run a very nice little restaurant. They're very good cooks of simple country food, and there's some very nice sections of wild, unrestored Great Wall there that you can walk on, and you can stay the night at their house. Very basic accommodation. And you should go soon if that sounds interesting to you, because there's an evil real estate group that's building apartments and they're snaking their way up the valley.
Is it like the Shaolin Temple?
It was the first signs went up was the Shaolin Temple Holding Company. And now it's...
The subtext is, our thugs can kick your thugs' ass.
Now it's a different company from Henan that is also somehow involved with the Shaolin Temple. And they're basically trying to kick all the peasant farmers off their land and build really ugly apartment buildings. But they haven't got up to the nice part of the valley yet, so you should go soon. GreatWallFresh.com.
Great. And this is like the third time you've recommended this.
Well, you know, you've got to keep advertising some things. All right, you know, very good. I'm a businessman, you know.
Chris Buckley, what do we have?
What do we have? We have a general thing I would like to recommend, which is a reminder that despite all the ideological tightening over the past few years, there's Chinese writers and historians and scholars who are doing great work. And I think it's really important, if you're interested in China, to not just read what's in Western languages, but to appreciate that there's people here doing really interesting work. And one of my favorite books on China's current generation of leaders is a book by an historian called Mia Du, who's an oral historian of the Cultural Revolution period. Wow. And this is his book, published under some difficulty, I think, called Xinlu, which is really an oral history about the Cultural Revolution generation. And I should stress that the names of the party leaders don't appear in it. That's not the point of the book. But as an exploration of what that this generation of Chinese people and leaders went through, and the marks that it left on their values and worldview and the extraordinary experiences they went through, I find nothing better than this. So I'm actually trying to read through it again. And I think if you go out there and go to the bookstores, there's still good work being done, and I think we should support it. My favorite bookstore in Beijing, I should say, is the All Sages bookstore out near Wudaokou. It's great.
Interesting. I'm going to do a non-China related recommendation. Actually, there's a guy out here in the audience, Anthony Tao, who once recommended to me a book called Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And I read that and loved it. And I read another novel of hers just recently called Half of a Yellow Sun, which is terrific. It takes place in the 1960s, the early 70s, during the Biafran Civil War, the Civil War for Biafran independence in Nigeria. Terrific writer. I'm just humane and funny and wonderful. And of course, it you learn an awful lot about especially the Igbo parts of Nigeria. So highly recommended. Have you read anything by her? She's very good.
No.
You should definitely check her out. Jeremy, what about you? Have you read her?
No, I have Americana in the pile of, I haven't gone there yet, next to the bed.
Okay, well, let's take this out and then take some questions for Chris. So, the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Thanks to Anla Cheng and to Soraya Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/SenecaPodcast and follow us on Twitter at SenecaPodcast. And thanks to all of you for coming and listening. Give it up for yourselves. All right. And take care. You're going to see rock and roll.
Rock and roll.